This is the Final Round Podcast, coming to you live from the FingerLakes1.com studios in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. And now your host, Chris Marquardt.
Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to episode number 60 of the Final Round Drag Racing Podcast. Excited to have all you folks tuning in with us this evening. It has been a long time since we've been on the air, roughly a month since we've been able to get everything to align schedule-wise. I had a trip to Topeka. Jason was in, I think you were in Minnesota and Albany and Michigan.
Right.
In between all of this, so been close to a month, but nonetheless, Jason making the trek out to the bustling metropolis of Seneca Falls to join us for episode number 60, and it's an episode that we come to you with a bit of a heavy heart. You know, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the one and only Dick Oldfield. He passed away last month. Tough to see him go. What a life and legacy that he leaves behind with his work with the missile, and I mean, the life story should easily be created into at least a 3-volume set of books with all the work that went into working on the team and the legacy that's both gladfully and woefully left behind.
I will say that there is a small section at least of about the missile in the Ram Chargers book, which I have at home. But certainly some parts of that will never go into any sort of book. There's stories those guys won't tell, or let you tell, put it in print. But overall, there's certainly lots and lots of stories to tell. That's for sure. It's been a bummer, I guess. I was thinking about this, and I kind of feel like 2019 has been kind of almost one big bummer. It certainly hasn't gotten off to a very good start. We had Jeff Jackson on the show, I think in 2019. It was either the end of 2018 or 2019. His dad passed away. Peggy Torelli right now. We've had John Torelli on the show, and Peggy is just out of the hospital. She's trying to battle with cancer right now, and Mike Verstel, his wife actually Tracy, was just in the hospital, is now home, and she started her chemo. Passing my uncle now is kind of like icing on the cake, if you will. I'm kind of hoping that 2019 turns the corner and gets a little bit better, I guess.
Sure. it would be nice. You had the chance to go. I'm trying to remember the timeline now. You had just to go out and see him.
Yeah.
See Dick before he passed away. His passing, I mean, is for lack of a more eloquent way to put it, almost coincided with your grandmother's birthday.
Right, right.
Right, so, I mean, a little bit of a downer there, I suppose.
Well, I mean, my grandmother's been dead for 20 years, but, yeah, it wasn't until my uncle passed that... I'm pretty sure it was the 14th of March was the exact date, and I was like, oh geez, yesterday was my grandmother, his mother's birthday, and I'm like, I mean, what a coincidence that is. And it's like, you wonder when people are getting to the end of their lives if they, you know, like that, do they try to hang on to meet certain dates, and it's like, all right, yeah, I made it to this date, I can go now. You just never know, I guess. But
right.
And I mean, you had asked multiple times about potentially having my uncle on the show over the last couple of years, and unfortunately his health was just not good enough to have him on the show. We've had Joe Pappas on the show. I'm trying to think if we've had any of the other missile guys on, but yeah, we just haven't had an opportunity, really, unfortunately, to have my uncle on, even though he was an integral part of the missile. And I thought it was kind of appropriate maybe to now that I guess, potentially that he was gone, to potentially, maybe do a tribute to him, if you will, and kind of talk more about his racing career, because I don't really know how much we've really talked about. I mean, we've mentioned certainly in the past that, he's been part of the missile team and race super stock and stuff like that. But, I guess I'm not one to brag. And unfortunately, he was never one to be in a position to be able to come on the show and tell the story firsthand. So
how was he when you went up and saw him? I mean, there was some debate right offhand at that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You weren't really knowing what you were walking into.
Right, right.
Then. Because yeah. he lived out... I've said this wrong so many times, I can't remember what's right. He lived outside of Detroit, right?
That's correct, yes. Right. Yeah, so this last couple of years of his life, he was outside of Detroit, living first with his daughter, and then for the last really 6 months, basically in a home. You're giving me the thumbs down?
Yes, because it would have been nice if they could have parked him in a garage next to a Mopar.
No. Yes, I will agree with that. He probably would have enjoyed that more too, quite honestly. The home was a bummer for sure, but I mean, it was a nice place. I mean, I don't hold it against my cousin for her taking him there. She just couldn't take care of him anymore, unfortunately. But yeah, thankfully, when we got the call that he was essentially being put into hospice care at that point in time, my mom and I really rushed out there. It might have been the next day. It was either the next day or the day after.
You were talking about it on finding out about it Wednesday or Thursday or Tuesday, Wednesday, because we had shuffled the show that week.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was that Wednesday or that Tuesday prior. And after that, you said you're leaving and you're going to be out there all weekend.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, and we left first thing Saturday morning, and we were out there at, you know, basically lunchtime. And I'm really glad that we did, just because the schedule-wise, the way my schedule was over March, I wasn't going to be able to get out there until the end of March, and he didn't make it that long. So, right. Yeah, I was really happy that we went out when we did. And when we did get out there, I mean, he was, you know, still cognizant, knew what was going on. I mean, was able to have a conversation, you know, was sitting up. So, I mean, though it wasn't under the best of circumstances, it was still a good visit. So, sure. It wasn't going and seeing somebody when they're essentially just comatose and all types of IVs hooked up to them. Yeah. And, you know, you don't want to see anybody like that, right?
No. I mean, we've been through, I mean, as adults, you go through this enough times to where you know that that's not the enduring memory you want out of the visit.
Yeah, no.
You don't want that.
Right.
And so many times there's that nobility of going in and sitting bedside and being there and all that other stuff, but that really makes for some shitty memories.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It turns out to be a pretty shitty trump card.
Okay, we're YouTube only this week.
I didn't even think about it, but I was just playing it back in my mind, you know. And
you're right.
And going through that, I mean, not to steal it, I didn't have anybody that had necessarily the legacy that Dick did.
Oh, no.
But it's still family, you know.
Oh, it's still family. And like, you're absolutely right. I mean, as you get to be an adult, you go through this a few times. And, yeah, there's two for me that really stick out in my head. Mark Pensa and another good friend of mine, Frank Monica, when the two of them passed away, it wasn't pretty. And it was really hard to see your good friends in really terrible states like that. Thankfully, I didn't have to see my uncle kind of in that same type of condition. And, granted, at the end of his life when we went and saw him, I mean, he wasn't the same guy he was, 5-6 years ago. Like I said, I mean, we still had a real nice visit. We took some goofy Instagram photos with filters and got some nice pictures. John Sebastian, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, probably, I guess, maybe he might have been the last show that we did a month ago. I took some models out that John built of my uncle's cars.
That's right. Yeah, what do you think of those?
Oh, he thought they were super cool. Yeah, yeah, he thought they were super cool, and we got some pictures of the three models in front of my uncle, and he thought that was really neat. So that was nice that to be able to do that. So again, under considering the circumstances, it was as good a visit as you could possibly have hoped for.
Sure, sure. So I mean, I have so many questions for you, and a lot of them I've pitched to you before. Just we were talking during our post-production meetings when we reflect on how great or poor the show went.
Sure.
and just like, when was the tipping point when you realized who your uncle was? Like, there's this point that you had to have crossed where my uncle, who also drives race cars,
yeah,
and my dad's brother, who also drives race cars, is kind of a big deal. And come to an appreciation of it.
You know, it probably honestly wasn't until much later in life after, you know, so my dad died in 91. It was certainly much after my dad died. And, you know, my uncle was always, he was always the cool uncle, always fun. Just, you know, and, you know, I think it was because of the fact that, you know, when we did things with him, it was always kind of race car centric or even just, I guess I'll call it, you know,
power. Like the cool uncle that gave you a Schaefer at 14 kind of cool or what?
Yeah. He was the cool, I mean, it's funny from a present standpoint, one Christmas, he got me this little Panasonic portable AM/FM radio, and the thing was the size of a credit card. It went into this little charger that you had to plug in the wall, and it was the super coolest thing ever. And and so yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, he was that kind of guy, right? I mean, yeah, for Christmas presents, you know, he was always going to bring you the neatest gift. And but it was just fun to hang out with him. And again, it was always car centric, racing centric, and I always loved that stuff as a kid. And we'd go visit shops and race shops, and you know, whether they be you know, parts places like Schmitz Performance, we go hang out at Schmitz Performance when he came in, or Jansen Automotive, and it was always fun to do that. But you know, he would, you know, kind of breeze into town Friday night after work. So he would, at the, let's call it at the end, when he was working at Chrysler, he'd work until, you know, 5 o'clock, immediately get in his car and drive up to Buffalo, and he'd spend Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, get up, we'd have breakfast, and then he'd, you know, out of town again the way he went. And yeah, we'd probably see him, I would guess, once a month, if you will. It wasn't certainly every weekend.
That's a lot, though.
Oh, it was a lot. Yeah, yeah, it absolutely positively was. I mean, overall, I mean, we always had a close relationship and, you know, spent quite a bit of time. And I will say that of, so, I mean, I had three.
When he came out, did he race?
I'm sorry?
When he came out, did he race? Did he find a car or jump in a
car? Oh, no, he was just, I mean, when he came out, he was, so, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, by the time that I can remember, or let's say by the time he was really coming into town, Don Carlton had already been killed.
Oh, okay. This is later.
So, yeah, and then really when he would come into town, I mean, he would come into town for Friday night, this is, but he was coming into town to basically hang out with my dad and help my dad with his race car, and yeah, maybe Saturdays, you know, he'd be working in the garage with us, helping us on the Corvette.
Right.
But yeah, at that point in time, for him, really, racing was done and over with. And I have to say that that all came to a screeching halt, really, when Don Carlton was killed.
Didn't you have a picture? You had a picture in this folder. It was him with the Corvette, right?
Yeah, there's one of him standing in front of, well, there's a, there might be a couple of them, but there's certainly one of them, I think, standing in the in my driveway. Yes, that one there. So I think that was right after the car was painted, maybe, that, you know, it was in the driveway, and my uncle happened to be in town that weekend, so.
That was a Buick.
Yeah, that's our, those are our neighbors, the Genusos. Bob always had Buicks. Yeah, so anyways, like I said, he was always just helping out, and, you know, he'd come to the races to watch or, you know, work in the garage. But, yeah, his racing was done and over with at that point in time. But you know, I had a close relationship with him as a kid, even, you know, before my dad passed away. But then after my dad passed away, him and I got even closer, especially low. It's amazing, actually, because he moved back into the house he grew up in. I mean, it was my grandmother's house and stayed in the family, and so he was back to the house he grew up in. But we did a lot of racing and traveling then. And, you know, it probably wasn't until then. So let's say 2000, 2005-ish. You know, I was 35 right, years old at that point when, you know, start doing reunions. And this is the other thing with my uncle. When Don Carlton was killed, I never really talked to him about it, you know, let's call it deeply and emotionally. But I know that it really hurt him. Don's wife, Johnny, was actually at my uncle's house at the time when they were testing. Don Carlton's kids were at the house. So my uncle had to be the one to tell Johnny that, hey, I'm sorry, but Donnie is dead. And for a long time, my uncle didn't really want to talk about the missile and all the stuff that they did, because I think it was just too hard, honestly. So yeah, it wasn't really until, again, when he moved back home in the early 2000s that all of a sudden it was like, yeah, let's start talking about that. And again, doing reunions and you know, Hall of Fame ceremonies and stuff like that. And
when did you go into the Hall of Fame? Because we had some pictures of of everybody. This is one of them when.
Yeah, so there was actually two Hall of...
This is the East Coast Drag Times.
Right, yeah, so the East Coast Drag Times Hall of Fame.
That was 2014.
Yeah, I would say there was two actual Hall of Fame ceremonies. So I think it was 2014 when he was inducted along with the rest of the Missile crew. A couple of years prior, we went down and the Ram Chargers were inducted. So a couple of the guys, Tom Hoover, Tom Hoover and who else? I should know this. Were actually inducted twice, basically, once as a member of the Ram Chargers and once as a member of the Missile crew. It wasn't Al. I should remember, but yeah. So that was, I would say that's my uncle after he got his plaque. Certainly one of his proudest moments, I would say. It'd be pretty, I don't expect that I will ever be inducted into any Hall of Fames before that I leave this planet.
We're only 60 episodes in, it's early.
Who knows, right? Yeah, I'll get into the, I don't know if it'll be the East Coast Drag Times Hall of Fame or the Podcast Hall of Fame or, you know, who knows.
Or the Please Mute Your Microphones Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I would say, I'm trying to think, what's that... Who's that famous guy on YouTube that blogs and has like 6 million followers and stuff?
There's a bunch.
PewDiePie. That's the guy I'm thinking. So, yeah, it'd be me and PewDiePie in the Internet Broadcasting Hall of Fame together, right? It was, like I said, he was very, very proud when he got inducted. I will say that I would have liked to have seen him inducted as an individual rather than part of a group, but that his racing career basically didn't, he was successful, but he just wasn't, he didn't race that long, quite frankly, on his own before he joined the Missile crew and was kind of all caught up in all of that. So
this is a Tom Cash
photo.
This is, now, correct me where I go astray here, because, again, some of the lineage gets me screwed up. This is his car with the Ram Chargers. This is the Iron Butterfly car?
So, not my uncle's car. This is Ted Spehar's car.
Okay.
So, basically, my uncle was racing his Dart, his good guy's Dart.
Okay.
So this would have been 69. So, 68 Dart, he gets it. He races it 1 year. 69, he starts racing it. He breaks the motor. I don't know what it is, halfway through the year or something like that. So my uncle's looking for a ride, and I don't remember who it was that hooked my uncle and Ted Spehar up. But somebody knew that my uncle was looking for a ride and that Ted Spehar was looking for a driver. There was somebody else that drove the Iron Butterfly for a race for Ted. And then, like I said, that was the car
that broke.
So, well, that's the car in 68. That's how it looked in 68. Okay. 69 was the darker maroon where it just said kind of the good guys and like a gold leaf on it. My uncle hated that 68 paint scheme, by the way. But he didn't have a say in that, honestly, because it was the Erie County Dodge dealers that, sponsored him, and they were the ones that laid out kind of how the paint was. So he had it repainted in 69, and same car, but just a different paint scheme. When he broke the motor, then, like I said, him and Ted Spehar got hooked up, and then at that point, he drove the Iron Butterfly, and I think it was at Dallas, the World Finals, where he drove that car, and things went pretty well. I want to say my uncle lost. I'm going to say in the semis. It might have been the finals, but I'm going to say he lost in the semis. And at that point, they had this new class that NHRA was talking about for 1970 for pro stock, and after the Iron Butterfly escapade, essentially, Ted Spehar approached my uncle and said, hey, we're going to be starting one of these pro stock teams with some backing from Chrysler, and do you want to be a part of that team and be my driver for that? And my uncle was like, heck yeah. So he only drove the Iron Butterfly for one or two races, and pretty much that was it.
So what's... We're jumping around a little now. I don't remember seeing this in our conversations.
Okay.
Where we looked at the different cars.
Yep.
And...
So that is Arlen Vanke's car.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, a pretty proud moment of my uncle. So my uncle and Arlen were good friends. And I will say they kind of lost touch for a while. But then I want to say I think the first time they reconnected, there was a car show that was out in Niagara County. And Arlen came in for that, and Judy Lilly came in for that. Tom Hoover was in for that, and they kind of reconnected. And anyways, long story short, Indy, this was, I think, the, let's see, I believe this was 2008.
Okay.
So it was, would that be the 50th anniversary of the Hemi? Let's see, 68, the Hemi cars, 68 to... That would have been 40 years. So maybe it was the 40th anniversary. So anyways, they asked Arlen to bring his car. Somebody else owned it, but they wanted him to bring his car there and be there at the U.S. Nationals and basically make a, you know, drive it up to the starting line and make a victory lap. The problem was is that Arlen's health wasn't all that great at that point in time, so he wasn't able to drive it. So my uncle actually drove the car while Arlen rode in it, and
yeah,
they made the victory lap, if you will,
right,
down the quarter mile. And, yeah, that was pretty cool. I love that picture. That picture's super cool, too. I don't know if the photographer's name is on there, but obviously that's one of the you know, professional photographers that goes to all the NHRA events, and just an awesome picture.
There it is. I don't see it. It looks like it's credited to NHRA.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure. Not sure who took it,
but yeah, super cool photo. And you know, Arlen was part of the Chrysler, let's call it the factory Chrysler team. So you know, he drove, you know, Chrysler products at Super Stock in 68, 69 when they went to Pro Stock. Arlen went to Pro Stock as well, and you know, he was one of the guys that. So the Missile team was factory backed by Chrysler, but was really a test car, and the technology that they developed basically as a test car then got shared with all of the other
right.
Chrysler teams, right? So yeah, and here's a perfect example. This is, and now at this point in time, this is 73. They had moved from the Motown Missile to the Mopar Missile, and this was them testing. I think this was at Gainesville. I'm not 100% certain of it, and I'm going to butcher this.
But these are all sensors, right?
So those are all just tufts of yarn.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have, I won't, well, yeah, they had, well, you can see on the front wheel, there's a wheel speed sensor on the front wheel. So the Missile team was one of the first ones to have an onboard data recorder. I mean, they called it a computer. I mean, it's really an onboard data recorder. And a big, huge thing that went in the trunk. And basically, anytime they went testing, that thing was there along with a support van, basically gathering all the telemetry from the car that they had sensors for. But yeah, here they were doing wind tunnel, let's call it, testing or aerodynamic testing. And I didn't have any pictures that I uploaded to my album here. But if you go to, and again, I'm going to butcher this. I think it's the Hamtramck. If you look that up on Google, I believe that was like the street that one of the Chrysler production facilities, assembly plants was on. But there, and that's, I think, the facility where the original Hemi Darts and Barracudas were produced. But if you look that up on Google, you'll find a site that has tons of pictures. My uncle took most of those pictures. He was always carrying his camera with him. And, took literally thousands of photos, and Stuart Pomeroy was nice enough probably 10 years ago to take all of those pictures and scan them and put them on this website. And there's a picture, one good picture of my uncle hanging out the window of the car with a high-speed camera as Don Carlton was driving the missile at full speed towards them, as they were trying to record essentially what's going on with these tufts of yarn as the car is going down the track.
We had that picture at some point. Remember that? We had, I don't remember what the...
That was probably when Joe Pappas was on, my guess. We probably showed that picture previously. And, yes, I remember, you know, Tom Hoover basically telling my uncle, I don't care what you do, Dick, but don't drop that camera because it's too expensive. We can't afford to replace it. So fall out of the car all you want, but just make sure the camera's safe.
That's crazy. I mean, here is... I think we had this one up a little bit earlier, but this is a later and earlier one. This was before it became the Mopar missile, but when Don was driving it, right there.
Yes. So the short story, for those that don't know or haven't seen the show before, essentially, 70, they create the Motown missile team, and my uncle is the driver. So 70 Challenger. Then what they do is Chrysler at that point in time was adamant that they had to use a clutch flight transmission.
Why?
That's what they wanted to sell. So because that's what they wanted to sell, that's what they wanted this car to have in it. the problem is the clutch flight just couldn't withstand the amount of horsepower that these guys were putting to the clutch flight. So they were breaking transmissions constantly. So at the end of the 70 season, even though when the car made it down the track, I will say that it was, you know, it was the world record holder. It was the fastest pro stocker out there when it would make it down the track. But at the end of the 70 season, Chrysler came and said, hey, look, you know, you guys aren't having the kind of success that we really want. You know, a lot of parts breakage, and we'd really like for you guys to get a different driver. And, you know, we've talked to Don Carlton, and we want Don Carlton to drive the car. And so Carlton came along and said, yeah, sure, I'll drive it, but I'm not driving it with a clutch flight in it. If you want me to drive it, you got to put a four-speed in it. So eventually, I guess after the Mexican standoff, essentially Chrysler agreed and said, okay, we'll allow you to put a four-speed in the car. So they put a four-speed in the car, and Carlton was a fantastic four-speed driver, and away they went. So they... From 70 to 71, it's actually the same car, but they just repainted it you know, put Carlton's name on it. And then it was 72 when the car went to, when it's all black with the gold leaf on the side. That was when, that was the CUDA. That's probably the most famous of the cars, of the missiles, and probably the most successful of them as well, though. You could potentially argue that because the Mopar missile was pretty successful as well.
So I'm trying to get this sized up right. It's not cooperating very well. There we go. This is a clipping out of a magazine or some promotional literature. Don is the driver, and there's your Uncle Dick right there.
Right, right. So actually the cover is in there as well. The cover is same color scheme, and I think this was for 72. But you'll see the cover that's in there in that album. It should be, at least. And it was a promotional flyer, essentially.
To sell clutch flights?
That wasn't for, well, like I said, that would have been 72. So clutch flight was gone at that point. I want to say that was for, I want to say that might have been for Liberty Transmissions. So there's the cover right there. So that's the CUDA. So then you open it up. It was kind of a four-page, four-page, if you will, a bifold. It had the car and little bios of the team members at that point in time. And, you know, the team members really... Whoops. Yeah, so that's the same one. So that was like page two or three on the inside. And, you know, that was the car, the CUDA was on the magazine of, you know, Hot Rod. You know, very famous picture of the car with the team, and But yeah, I mean, the team, the actual team itself was very large. But yeah, so there's the, I guess it was the Lee Eliminators. They were, I think they were the ones that made that. But yeah, you can see overall the sponsors. But who knows? All those guys were sponsors. I mean, Trick Titanium, Liberty Gear. So maybe it was something that they made up as a team, as you know, a handout for the track. I'm not 100% sure. Joe Pappas would probably know the answer to that question.
There's a bunch of different. I don't know which one to go with. This is the black car. You said this is the most famous one. Then why? What was the change to the Barracuda? Was there a logical reason why, or they just wanted to sell Barracudas?
You know, my guess is that it was probably that they just wanted to sell Barracudas. Yeah, I don't know otherwise, quite honestly. You know, and that again is probably where, you know, Joe Pappas might know the answer. Yeah, I mean, I think that car was the most famous because of the fact that, you know, I have to say, I mean, obviously, I'd love the Challenger with my uncle's name on it. I mean, that's always going to be the one that I have a soft spot in my heart for. But, I mean, the Cuda is cool looking for sure. And I think, you know, the contrast of the gold lettering on the black, and then you take into account that the fact that, you know, the car was very successful. I think that's why, you know, people really were drawn to that particular car. It's funny, too, because, you know, I won't say they were the bad guys, but, you know, they kind of embraced that to a certain extent. You know, Ronnie Sox was the, you know, the guy in the white car, and he was the, you know, he was the sheriff, and, you know, the missile crew was, you know, Dirty Dan that, you know, came into town and stirred up trouble and, you know, tried to take down the good guy. And so, I mean, they had a little bit of play there between the two cars. But again, they were on the same team. So in the end, you know, technology, not to say that Ronnie Sox didn't do things on his own, because he certainly did. But yeah, like I said, technology they developed with the missile then went to Ronnie Sox if there was something to be told there.
And this is when Dick drove it.
Yes, correct. So that's the Challenger, right? So yeah, that had the silver leaf on the side and Fernwood Dodge. That I'm fairly certain was Ted Spehar's garage.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a 70 car. So 70, 71 car is exactly the same, just painted differently. I don't like the way that the car looks in 71. It's kind of got a mustard yellow on the side of it, and I'm not really.
It's a weird one.
Yeah, I'm not really crazy about that. The 70 colors I like, but I'm not really crazy about how they painted it for 71. But you know, again, I'm sure Chrysler was calling the shots when they painted the car that color. And
This is what you're talking about.
Yeah, now. Yeah.
It's a little different.
Yeah, and I'm just not crazy about that. You know, I mean, I don't mind yellow, I guess, as a highlight. I've never been a big yellow car guy, and I'm definitely not a big mustard yellow fan.
Yep.
So yeah, that was all. So I mean, that was all. You know, after my uncle had got done racing super stock and all the rest of that stuff, and most of the guys. So at that point in time, yeah, after the 72 car, they went to the in 73. They went to the Mopar missile, and so I mean that's a duster, I guess, because it's a Plymouth rather than a Demon. But you know, same thing overall. I'm fairly certain that was when the car was just finished and pushed out of. So I think, trying to remember where that car was built, if that was at Ted's shop or if that was then at Specialized Vehicles.
Shop.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, again, I mean, this is the type of thing where I kind of wish I would have taken a video camera, right, and had all these conversations with my uncle and videotaped them all. because yeah, I mean, I just didn't know. I wasn't around at that point in time. But you know, the real finer details about, you know, what was taking place. I mean, like I said, Specialized Vehicles kind of came into play at some point in time, and that might have been Ted's shop. Ted might have owned Specialized Vehicles, and they were building different things, and they were building test cars for Chrysler for all different types of projects and stuff like that. I do remember going to the shop, but yeah, I don't remember spending a lot of time there.
And at some point, we've got the white dart that your uncle was photographed with a bunch of times. That's not any connection to...
That's his car.
That was his car, but it wasn't a connection to the originals, right? That wasn't just repainted. Or was that one of the missile cars? This car here. Let me find it again. I had a bunch of pictures of it queued up, and we ended up going on a different riff.
So, yeah, my guess is the white Hemi dart that you're talking about is probably from the Elkton Hemi reunion, which that car, that white painted dart, that is his actual good guy's Hemi dart that he raced. Yeah, that is the actual car. You know, it's funny because I guess that's the thing. When you have a vehicle where there's only 63 of them produced...
And you were wrecked, you know?
Well, and I will say, I think right now, probably the definitive database for Hemi darts and what happened to them is on Class Racer. There's a thread in there, and pretty much every car is accounted for.
Really?
Somebody did some ridiculous research, and yes, almost every car is accounted for. What happened to it, and where did it go? And at the Elkton reunion, there was a whole bunch of cars there, original 68 Hemi darts. And again, I think, you know, when you have a very small production run like that, and it's a car that people are really fond of and big fans of, when they change hands, people generally know where they go. Of the 63, or it's like 63 cars that they produced, I want to say all but maybe like, I'll say three of them are accounted for and they know exactly where they are. There's only like three of them that aren't. So that was when my uncle first saw the car. And I have to say, that was the hottest I've ever been. you typically don't think of Minnesota and hot, but this was southern Minnesota. I actually couldn't stay the whole 3 days. On Saturday, I had to go home early. I just couldn't take it outside anymore. It was so hot. And but we got there on a Thursday, I think, and they walked us over there before really anybody got there. And they're like, Dick, come here. We got to take you down and show you your car. And so this was when he first had seen it. And he hadn't seen that car since... basically, he sold it in 1969, in the middle of 69. So,
he never actually got his hands back on it, but he's able to be reunited with the car.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't actually have the chance to own it again.
Yeah. No, he never had a chance to own it again. And that is the car because the fact that of VIN numbers and stuff like that. That's the thing that they did. They did VIN number tracking on these things, and that's the actual VIN number of my uncle's car. It's somebody had a list someplace from Chrysler somehow. So they had an original list essentially of the VINs and where those cars were, who those cars were allocated to.
Right.
So then they were able to basically go back and just trace, okay, well, here's the VIN number. Whose car is this? Oh, okay, this was Arlen Mankey's car. Okay, this was Dick Oldfield's car. I shouldn't say Arlen Mankey. He had a Barracuda. He didn't have a Dart. But
I think we all understand.
Yeah. But, yeah, pretty cool. That was a really neat event. I'm glad.
Where did they find it? I mean, what was it? Was it a race car all along? Did they find it someplace?
It was a race car all along. It was a race car the whole thing. It was a race car its entire life. The guy that owns it now, or I should say, at that point in time, he was still bracket racing it in Minnesota. He lived in Minnesota and bracket raced it at Brainerd. You can see on the windshield there's
the
competition numbers on it. So yeah, he was still racing it. I don't know if
kind of pair.
It's one of those things. It's like, all right, yeah, it's a Hemi dart. There's plenty of guys out there that are still racing them in super stock, in particular, Hemi darts and Barracudas. But yeah, at some point, you might have to say, all right, does it really make sense to do this versus just restore it and sell it and take the money and go do something else?
Why not?
I know I had thought at one point in time it'd be super cool to get that car. But I also knew, you know, that I can't afford that car. That car is just, you know, out of my league from a cost standpoint at this point in time. I mean, they're quite valuable, as you know, and probably anybody that's watching the show knows. So at one point, I actually thought that, well, geez, it'd be cool to get. So that's the 69 paint job right there.
That's the weird bulge, the goldfish side of the gold.
Yeah,
the good guys won.
Yeah,
and that's now the white one that's in Minnesota.
That's correct. Yep.
It's so cool.
Yep. Yeah, so after I decided that I couldn't afford the Dart, I thought, well, maybe I could get my uncle's Mercury Comet. But that car is even more rare than the Dart is. So when I found out that they only had built, I think, five of those Comets, I'm like, okay, well, if I can't afford the Dart and they built 63 of them, I'm sure I can't afford the Comet if they only built five of those.
I had the Comet.
So there's two pictures of the Comet, two different, I guess, paint schemes of the Comet. One where it's maroon,
right,
and it says Cirillo Motors on the side.
That's the one that I recognized from before. Here we go.
Yep. So I think that picture, again, this is the tough thing, too, to remember. It's like, you know, 40 years later, it's like you're asking a guy, well, where was this picture taken? He's like, I think that was at Englishtown. And it's like, you know, was it Englishtown? I mean, yeah, who knows? I don't know. I mean, it could have been Cecil County. It could have been, for the most part at that point in time, he was only racing on the East Coast. But so that car actually was owned previously by a guy by the name of John Rossi. And they took that car away from him, Ford did, and my uncle basically went to the Ford dealership and said, hey, I want a race car. And they're like, who the heck are you? And he bullshitted them and told them that, you know, he was some super successful, you know, race car driver. And so they got him that car. Now, they had taken the motor out of it. And I am not a Ford guy at all, so I don't know any of the details. But so those cars, when they were originally built, came with some super rare motor. And that was, let's call it the good motor. By the time my uncle had gotten it, they had taken the motor out of it, and then they had shipped him a Cammer motor, I'm pretty sure is what it was, a Cammer motor. And that motor wasn't quite as good as the original motor that was in the car. But so he put that motor in it and ran that car in 60... Oh, my God, let me see here. So this was in 60... I think it was the end of 66 and 60, yeah, end of 66 and 67. So in 67, he repainted it gold. And in this picture here, this is when he had already painted it gold. Now, I don't think my uncle, did it say like the satellite or something on the side of it there?
No. None of the pictures when it was gold had any like, well, that attribution picture, or nickname. There's the color picture of the gold.
That's the car there. I mean, that literally was, he just pushed it out of the garage after he painted it. That was his first attempt at a paint job. So yeah, he just pushed it out of the garage. But after he sold it, the guy, the Orbiter, I think maybe it was called. You can see it on the quarter panel of one of the pictures. I think it says the Orbiter or something like that.
I see there's the gold fender. And then there's another nickname on the side. That one, I found one here. That still says Jansen on the side.
Okay, so Jansen is my uncle still. Gold Thunder, I mean, that was the same car after he had sold it. He never named it. He just put Jansen on the side at one point in time.
Yeah.
So he ran that car, like I said, in part of 66, then repainted it from maroon to the gold in 67. And at the end of 67 is when he sold it. And, it's funny because at the end of 67, I think he couldn't be competitive. I think that's what the issue was. He couldn't be competitive with that car anymore. So he went back to Ford and said, this car's just not going to cut it. I got to get, something better. And I think at that point in time, they were like, okay, yeah, well, we'll put you on the list for, a Mustang. And he basically said, up yours. I'm going to go talk to the other manufacturers. So he went to Dodge, and Dodge said, yeah, we got these 68 Hemi darts coming out. We can get you one of those. Okay, great. I'll take it. Called Ford up and said, hey, come get your car because I'm done with you guys.
Right.
And that was when he switched to the dart.
So does anybody know where that Comet is? Is it known?
Yes. So that Comet, actually, I found that we never got the opportunity, unfortunately, but a collector in, I want to say, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, somewhere around there, owns that car.
So that
and it's fully restored to its original form.
Original being?
So I think the very first person who had that car was Arnie Beswick, I believe.
Okay.
So
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. So the car is completely restored. I don't remember how the heck I found that, but I was doing some research and happened to find it on the internet someplace. And it's been completely restored to its original condition, and that car is probably worth $500,000.
Right. you won't be owning that.
No, I will not be owning that car. I have to say, I'm not a Ford guy at all, as you know.
0.0.
Well, I mean, it's funny just because of the fact that, you know, really in my family, we raced all three brands, right? I mean, all the big three, let's call it in the U.S., we raced all three.
Right.
I grew up in a household where it was, you know, strictly Chevy, specifically a Chevy Corvette, obviously. I'm not really a Ford fan, but I really do like the lines on the Comet. And I have to say that in general, I kind of like the design of cars like that, that have those sharp angles and stuff like that. So, yeah, I like the Dart. I like the older GTOs. I like, I like the Comet. And, I will say that the Corvette is funny. The 63 Corvette's kind of the antithesis to that, right? I mean,
quite.
I do like, when I was in high school, I had a 78 Malibu. It's basically a box for the most part. But, I've always liked cars that have had sharp, hard lines like that, and that was definitely the Comet from the 66 time frame.
So we were talking about cars that were found and where they were at, and there's this.
Yes. So that's
this. Not the proudest day.
So that's a 72 car. And, that's a 72 car, and I will say that, my uncle and I, Mark Williamson, still owns that car. Interesting side note, I guess I will get to in a second. I don't even know if it's true. So all I know is what I was told is that Mark Williamson still owns that car. He took on a partner, and I don't remember the name of the guys off the top of my head. So this guy owns a collision shop down in Mississippi, and they fully restored the car. And what I understand is that that guy has now passed away. So I don't know what the status of this car is now.
Now, who's the guy that had like 4 or 5?
Arnie Klann is the guy that owns 4 or 5. He flew out from California for my uncle's service.
Really?
And so he's an ordained minister. So he actually did the service in Michigan, and then once they transported my uncle's body to Buffalo, he did the final funeral service at the gravesite as well. But
he logged some miles too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yep. This is how we found the car. I mean, sitting under a couple of cheap tarps up in Ottawa, and it was literally -30 degrees Fahrenheit that day. It was the coldest I had ever been in my entire life.
Uncle was with you when you found it.
Oh, yeah. But my uncle, I don't remember how my uncle got tied up with Mark Williamson, but basically it got to the point where it's like, hey, I'm going to go up there and take a look at this car, and guy thinks he might have, the 72 car. I'm like, all right, well, let's drive up there. So, yeah, we drove up there, and, it didn't take too long for my uncle to see some of the stuff on the car and, basically realize that, oh, yeah, this is the car because I remember doing this on it and I remember doing that on it. And, the short story is, for people that don't know, is that, after my uncle was removed as driver, again, he remained on the team as a crew member. Well, he was one of the big fabricators. So he was building essentially chassis and you know, roll cages and brackets and stuff like that. So yeah, he was just a welder fabricator, basically, extraordinaire.
And you remembered all the...
Yeah. So he was able to get, you know, and it's funny because we went and looked at a couple of cars that people thought were that car.
Yeah.
We made a trip out to Ohio for a car that someone thought was a missile. And so like, we went and looked at it, and my uncle's like, no, this is definitely not the car. He's like, I didn't do this, and I definitely would not have done that. And
did it crush that poor person's dreams?
To a certain extent. But, you know, it's funny. You know, at that point in time, it's like, all right, the guy, I'm sure the person gets bummed, but at the same point in time, they then continue on. It's like, well, this is what I was told when I bought this car, is that this was a Motown missile. And like the one that we came to find out, it was a car that was owned by Mike Fonz. This is where it gets kind of crazy and blurry and tough to remember, is that, so at the end of the 72 season, Ted Spehar sold the Motown Missile name to Mike Fonz, and Mike Fonz continued to basically tour the country with Motown Missile on the side of his car. Mm-hmm. He was doing it just for PR purposes, essentially.
Right.
Hey, look, I can get free PR because I have this famous name on the side of my car.
Sure.
They had moved on to the Mopar Missile, and those teams had nothing to do with each other. So there were two or three different cars out there that had Motown Missile on the side that were Fonz cars. And what happened is that people that weren't totally in the know eventually, oh, it's like, oh, I bought myself a Motown Missile. So this one car that we happened to find in Ohio happened to be a car that Mike Fonz owned, who sold to Irv Beringhaus, and who knows what happened to it then. Right. So I mean, eventually you uncover the history of the car, and you know, for better
Fonz
or worse.
Fonz has some of the, no, you mentioned a minute ago, who has the originals, like has almost a complete set, right, of the original cars.
Arnie has two cars. So Arnie has, well, we'll call it two cars. So Arnie has the 70-71 car, which is the same car, two different paint jobs, but he has the 70-71 car, which is fully restored and painted in the 71 paint scheme. Mm-hmm. Then he also owns the wire car, and the wire car was never competed with. So that was a car that they built. They got it done. NHRA looked at it and said, oh, no, you are not racing this. We do not approve. And then it got shelved, and then it got sent down to Don Carlton's shop, and then it was sold to, at one point in time, I knew the woman's name, some woman and her husband, and she bracket raced it in North Carolina and crashed it. And I don't remember where Arnie found it, but he found the wire car, bought it, and they've restored it. And you know, it's hard. They did put Motown Missile on the side of it, I think. Motown Missile? Mopar Missile? Might have been Mopar Missile that they put on the side of it. You know, the car was never finished. So my uncle was helping Arnie kind of do that restoration. You know, there was lots of questions like, well, what do you do with this car, right? How do you paint it? When it left, it was basically just still in primer. So, you know, it was never officially a missile car, but it was a car that those guys built.
And there wasn't he working on a third?
So those are the only two cars that he has. So the Cuda, again, Mark Williamson still owns, and that's right. That kind of joint venture. Then there's the Mopar Missile, the 73 car. I'm pretty sure it's Ben Donoff that owns that car. I don't know if it's Ben that owns it or drives it. I think Ben owns it. And that car was
pictures of that on the show before.
Yeah. So that car was in the Garlitz Museum for a while. And he's pulled it out, and he's done some Nostalgia Pro Stock racing with it, and he's taken that car to a couple of the reunions and the Drag Time Hall of Fame shows and stuff like that. So I know that Arnie would love to get his hands on those cars too, so he had essentially the whole collection, if you will. But now the other car that Arnie, I don't know if he bought it or not. I want to say he did buy one of the Colts recently. So that was the other thing. I mean, so after Chrysler basically pulled out and said, okay, we're not going to be a Chrysler factory team anymore, these guys continued to race, and they started building some Colts. And I thought Arnie had told me that he just at the funeral that he had just bought a Colt, but that I can't confirm that. My memory is terrible.
The Colt sticks out to me too. When we had a conversation about that before, like he was looking at it or something. That's where I wonder if that's where that third car came from.
That's very possible. Yeah, that's very possible. Yeah, I mean, it's funny is that the one Colt, and I don't know which one it was because they built a few of them. So Mr. Hoover was living down in the Virginia area and literally happened to be like driving down the road and turned and looked into a garage, repair shop, and it's like, that's a Dodge Colt. Backs up and goes in there and, yeah, comes to find out that this is, my uncle, I think, actually ended up going down there to look at the car with Tom Hoover, and they confirmed, yeah, this was one of the Colts that they built.
Wow.
Yeah, just total coincidence, right? Right? Yeah, and this car had been within 30 minutes of Mr. Hoover's house for, 10 years. He never knew it was there.
That that guy must have been beside himself when they went into the shop.
Yeah, I'm sure, right?
I built this car. Yeah, right. No, no, seriously.
Yeah, and who are you? Yeah, it's funny because, again, Tom Hoover is very well known now in the nostalgia racing circles, I guess, or drag racing circles. But, he's the father of the Hemi, basically. That's what he's called. And if you would have asked somebody in, 1985 or even 1995, who Tom Hoover is, most people would have been like, never heard of him. And if you did say Tom Hoover, Tom Hoover the drag racer, most people thought, Tom Hoover, the guy who owned the Showtime Funny Cars that were out of Minnesota. It's like, nope, that's a different Tom Hoover. No relation.
Cool. Yes. True. But.
Yes. Right. So.
This was one of the last pictures that was in the album that we didn't get to.
Yeah, that was me. One of my rare wins at Empire Dragway. It's funny because I actually won back to back, and I won't say it was back to back weeks, but it was back to back times that I went out there because I was traveling pretty heavily at the time. And when we were going out, we were just we were complete test mode. That's all it was. I basically was always ET racing and dialing 990 or 1090 essentially on the car. And my uncle happened to be there that weekend when we won, and it was nice to, it was a very impromptu, all right, hey, you want to go to the winner's circle? So I went to the winner's circle and got our picture taken. And, those are certainly some of the good memories.
Right.
And like I said, we had a lot of fun, did a lot of traveling. Remember going to Chicago, driving all night with him, and going to Chicago to race there just to have myself be a jerk essentially in red light first or second round. I got in a staging battle with Tony Fuller, and in the end my uncle read me the riot act when I got back. He was mad. He was really mad because of the fact that I red lighted, and he's like, I don't know what the hell you were doing. You should have just staged the car like you always do, and you would have had a good reaction time, and you would have beat that guy. And he was quite upset. it's funny too because it was one of those times that sticks out, because I was always really hard on my dad when my dad would make mistakes, and it was like, huh, so this is what it's like to be yelled at the restaurant.
with all those experiences, obviously there's tons of memories that stick out over the course of all the time and the travel and stuff like that. But was there any information or any stories that you never could get out of them?
No, not really. I will say that, for the most part, anything you wanted to hear, he'd be more than willing to tell you. And, there were certainly some stories that I heard that I wouldn't repeat on air. I tried to look for a picture. There's a picture of my uncle, and thankfully my cousin Susie, she had it on a slideshow at the funeral. But one of these winter times, the whole team had gone down to Cancun or something like that on vacation. And they're on a boat, and there's like four or five of them in this picture. And my uncle is just, you know, kind of making this crazy face. And you could just tell in this picture that he's, you know, kind of wild and out of control. And, and you know, really, I know that, you know, my uncle, that was the guy. It's amazing. It's sad that he's gone. He lived to be, you know, 76 years old or whatever it was. But he lived a full life, and quite honestly, it was a miracle probably that he made it to 76 years old. You know, between, you know, wrecking motorcycles and cars and, you know, who knows, you know, being in his 20s, early 30s, in the 70s, and all the illicit substances that were consumed in the late 60s and 70s, right? It's like, and my uncle was a partier, so I know that, yeah, he had a lot of fun in his life. I mean, there he is. I mean, here they are doing hood scoop testing, you know, big, huge smile, Alpar. So there's Alpar.com. So, I mean, that's...
This is another Pomeroy photo.
But yeah, and I don't know who took this picture, because Stuart more than likely wasn't at the track, but this was part of my uncle's collection that that Stuart then scanned. But yeah, those guys had a lot of fun. And I think that's probably why, to a certain extent, it was... hard for them, you know, when Donnie died, because of the fact that, you know, they were not only co-workers, but, you know, really friends, and had a lot of fun on and off the track.
Sure.
We got to wait probably another 10 or 20 years once everybody is dead, then I can start telling some of the some of these stories.
There's no repercussions at that point, right?
Yeah, there's cool. There's a good one with Don Carlton that I definitely can't tell.
Don't do that.
Yeah, definitely can't tell that story yet. Like I said, maybe 10 or 20 years from now, but
interesting. What else we got?
Well, I think that's a pretty nice synopsis overall of you know, my uncle's racing career. And, you know, obviously, you know, it wasn't just his racing career, but obviously he was you know, a husband and father and grandfather, uncle as well. And you know, I have to say that I probably maybe have said this on the air before, but I mean, he really owed his entire career to drag racing. And you know, it was something that he initially had an interest in. And once he got out of racing, I mean, he went to work at American Motors, basically in purchasing, essentially. They got bought by Chrysler, and he was kind of, you know, let's call it back with the Chrysler gang again, and that's where he retired from. And all of that came out of drag racing, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, certainly I'm not going to say that, you know, he was he wasn't going to win probably, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize or anything like that. I mean, he was, you know, your typical guy. I'm sure there was, you know, fisticuffs at times and stuff like that. But, yeah, overall, a lot of fun, and people generally got along with him and enjoyed themselves.
Right.
I think I've told you the story about being down at Joe Jurincek's boat with Billy Lieber and possibly going on the haunted hayride with him. And I didn't tell you any of these stories.
I don't think so.
Oh,
I don't remember.
Well, my uncle wasn't. I'm sure my uncle had a few scotches in him at the time, but like the Joe Jurincek story. So we went down there to deliver Joe's Pantera. He just bought a Pantera, so we deliver it down there. And long story short, Joe gets absolutely obliterated, and. The bar that we're at is right next to essentially the marina where the boat is kept. So he decides he's going to drive it back. So Billy gets in the car with him, and they start riding back. And I can hear in the background, I can hear this car. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, Billy is going to die. They're both going to die. Well, at some point in time, they pull up to a stop sign. Now, this car had been sitting there for like 10 years before he bought it. And we just, like I said, we literally just trailered it back to Detroit. And they pull up to a stop sign, and Joe has the car in fourth gear and drops the clutch, and it stalls. While the battery is a 20-year-old battery that had been sitting for 10 years. And so there's no start in this thing. So we go and we end up basically Billy walks back to the marina, comes and gets me. We take his little dirt bike and battery charger and a generator basically back out to the car to get this thing started. And of course we find Joe sleeping in the passenger seat of the Pantera as he was waiting for us. And, you know, Joe and my uncle were real good friends. And, you know, this was, you know, these are the types of characters that my uncle, you know, would get us all hooked up with. And I still talk to Joe and his wife, Shannon, occasionally. They're great people. They're super nice people and definitely very, very fun. But yeah, that was my uncle's life kind of in a nutshell, right? Let's go have some fun.
Right. Well, he managed it. You know,
He managed plenty of fun for sure.
He accomplished every last bit of that. And it left a legacy. I mean, for sure. It's been rare. I mean, I'm obviously biased. You know, I like all the Mopar stuff.
Sure,
right. But I think it's been rare that we've had an episode come through that somehow we didn't meander our way back to an anecdote of some sort to the Mopar missile or the Motown missile and your uncle's role with it.
Yeah, we've certainly talked about it. You know, on or off piece. A little piece here, a little piece there. I don't know that we've ever really done more of a, you know, let's call it all inclusive. You know, even the very first time I was ever on a show with you, which would have been back in 31st lap, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
I'm sure we talked about it because I mean, as you interviewed me and asked, all right, so what's the background and stuff? So I'm sure we talked about it. But
we got into some of it with Joe, but I mean, that was. It wasn't all your uncle's background.
Yeah, that wasn't all my uncle, right? That was more missile-centric type of thing. And yeah, because my uncle didn't know Joe until Joe joined the missile team. And I want to say that I don't think Joe joined until 72. It was later that Joe did. Joe was helping Mike Fonz. Joe was working for Mike Fonz. And then joined the missile team, and then I don't know how long Joe stayed on at that point until Joe decided, hey, you know what, I've had, I won't say that I had enough of the race cars, but maybe it's time for me to grow up and go out and get my engineering degree and go get a real job.
So much enough of the race cars, but enough of the fun, huh?
Yeah. It's funny, I don't know that my wife had ever met Joe up until my uncle's wake and funeral you know, a week ago. And Joe and his wife Lynn are just super people, really, really nice people. And yeah, my wife texted me like the next day after the funeral, and she's like, you know, is that Joe Pappas guy single? Because I think that, you know, him and your mom would get along great. And I'm like, Joe is married very happily. And he's like, he's just a super nice guy. And he's like, yes, he is a super nice guy. And it's hard to imagine Joe honestly hanging around my uncle and those bunch of degenerates, because he just is so nice and so polite and very professional. And but yeah, obviously I guess in the early 70s he wanted to have some fun too, so he hung around the missile team.
Well, they certainly found it, and with the passing of Dick Oldfield go so many stories that we might not ever come across, you know, which is one of the sad things when somebody likes this go. And I joked about it early on, but I mean, with just what we were able to cover tonight to elaborate out and document the history, you know, that's a life story well worth documenting, that at some point, if it hasn't been in a book, beside of that little snippet that you referenced a bit ago, I certainly think that you could get some mileage out of that. It was a heck of a life.
Yeah, it definitely was. I'm pretty sure he did just about everything that he wanted to do. Probably about the only thing I will say is that the only thing that I knew that was still on his bucket list that we never got a chance to do, that we talked about going to Scotland and doing you know, tour of the distilleries in Scotland. And, you know, my family, part of my family is from Scotland, and so we talked about doing that. But I think that's about the only thing that I can think of that might have been on his list of things to do that he didn't do. Otherwise, Yeah, it was like, work? Nah, I'm not going to work. I'm going to go race. And racing turned in. He was lucky enough that, you know, I guess I'll say lucky enough, but at the same point in time, driven enough, really, to say, I don't care what it takes. I mean, he literally sold his furniture at one point in time to go racing. my aunt wasn't very happy about it, but yeah, he literally sold his furniture to go racing, and that's what he wanted to do. And like I said, he was driven enough and maybe dumb enough, I guess, to say, yeah, I don't care. I'm not going to go out. And he could have never had a 9-to-5 job when he was earlier. I was actually telling somebody the story. He worked at the Chevy Tonawanda plant for a very short period of time. Couldn't do that. Worked at Janssen for a while until Mr. Janus, Jim Janus Sr. came to him and said, hey, look, you need to decide what you're doing. You're going to work here or you're going to race. And he said, okay, I quit. I'm going racing. yeah, I mean, he couldn't do it. And yeah, like I said, he was lucky enough that I guess he made the right choices in life because he ended up right. doing okay.
Yeah, he's very smart or very dumb.
Yeah, there's probably times where it was some of both, I would guess.
Equal parts. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm going to miss the guy. I'm glad I had an opportunity to, I guess, tell a little bit of my uncle's life story. Yeah, wish we would have had the opportunity, you know, 5 years ago and could have had him on the show, but this will have to do.
It'll have to do for now.
Yeah.
Episode 60 in the books. We appreciate all the folks tuning in and hanging out with us again as we remember Dick Oldfield, the original driver of the Motown Missile.